Welcome to A State of Readiness, a podcast set as a fireside chat with business leaders to discuss what it takes for a company to be in a state of readiness and become a high performance organization with your host, Joseph Paris. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another edition of State of Readiness, a podcast set as a fireside chat between me, Joseph Paris, your host, and a business leader who is brave enough to volunteer to be on the show. So today we have Joe Vacca, and Joe has 25 years of leadership experience in operations and finance with an emphasis on continuous improvement and enterprise efficiency. He's worked across insurance, financial services, and healthcare industries at companies including General Electric, MassMutual, Aetna, and Cigna. He's also invested considerable time assisting community-based organizations with achieving their goals. Joe's been a practicing Six Sigma Black Belt since 2004 with ASQ certifications for Black Belt CSSMBB and Lean LSC. He has a bachelor's degree in economics and psychology from St. Lawrence University, summa cum laude, and MBA from Rensselaer Lally School of Management up there near Albany. He's also a graduate of GE's renowned financial management program and Cigna's financial development program, which he then directed upon graduation. Joe lives in Connecticut with his wife and two daughters and enjoys outdoor sports and wellness activities such as hiking, running, biking, and in his free time. So welcome, Joe, to the show.
Hey, Joe. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. My pleasure. You know, you and I have had a couple of conversations, and I'm grooving on your story, of course, and I'm really appreciative of your taking the time and joining us today.
Yeah. And Joe, I got to say, it's a first for me in terms of podcasts. So really do appreciate the opportunity and appreciate you bringing these stories to the Operational Excellence audience. I've listened to a few and, just real pleased to be a part of what you're building here.
Yeah, thanks for that. I'm fascinated with other people's stories. I mean, one of the reasons why I do this podcast, probably the primary reason I do this podcast, is that, everybody's story is different. They might do similar things, but, how they got to where they are, I find fascinating. And I find fascinating, for instance, that, your bachelor's degree is in economics and psychology. And, how does that play into your continuous improvement journey?
Well, the economic side as a foundation, it plays in every day in terms of understanding financial impacts, process impacts. I don't think a day goes by that I'm not working on a project where a business leader will ask, so what is the overall impact of what we're doing? Or help me understand the impact of this emerging problem. And the underlying economics foundation is almost ideal to do that type of analysis. The psychology side is interesting. I didn't choose that major, and I'm just flashing back 25 plus years now to college, but it was more out of enjoyment. I had finished my economics major early, and I just found the psychology side insightful in terms of how people think and behave. And it seemed like something that could be really beneficial as I was going to enter the business world. I was pretty certain at that point to combine some of the logic of economics and how it could be applied to business with the people side of it. I thought that might be a pretty powerful combination.
Yeah, well, here we are in the middle of the, COVID-19 crisis as this plays out today. And, I think about the economics and psychology as it's playing out in the markets right now. I mean, you could almost see the herd mentality.
Yeah, absolutely. It's, uncertain times and an unprecedented event. This may be how I'm now slanted being an operational excellence professional, but what I found my brain gravitating to is the problem-solving nature of this epidemic, and in a good way. If I think of the way in which, you know, people are coming together to solve a problem, and I think of the common purpose behind it, and how difficult. Like, think of in your day-to-day work, you could have people within a team or across a couple of different teams, and you can't necessarily easily get them to agree on what a particular problem is that you're trying to solve. And now you have the country and even the world coming together with a pretty clear purpose and a growing understanding of what's causing the problem and a willingness to do what's necessary, each doing our part to be able to help solve or at least slow the problem so that we're collectively better off. It makes me smile in a way, as hard as the situation is, but it's almost a lesson learned as you kind of take it back to the micro environment that we all work in, whether it's in a corporation or an education system, government. As problems come up, it crystallizes the importance of having a common purpose and a common goal in problem solving.
Yeah, you know, we always talk about alignment and commitment, right? You know, we're all getting aligned to what the nature of the calamity is, and incrementally as that alignment is occurring, you know, you see increasing commitment to engage. And I see, you know, it's still early, I think, in the game, but you're now seeing the willingness to start cooperating where cooperation might not have existed, or even the avenues for cooperation. I guess that's a better way of saying it. The avenues for cooperation did not exist and are being built fairly rapidly, at least, you know, from my perspective.
Absolutely. And it's forcing different thinking on ways of doing things. So, you know, with every challenge comes new opportunity. And if you think of how it's forcing us to flex in terms of work at home arrangements, remote meetings, you know, it's challenging us in different ways, and which inevitably creates better ways of doing things and possibly even innovation. So you can hear me a little bit slanted to the upside of things, but I think it is a natural outcome when we're challenged in this way.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting that you say, you know, trying new things. You know, I'm on the advisory board of Binghamton University's System Science and Industrial Engineering Department, and you know, earlier in this week, before it was even announced, I was speaking with the chair of the department, and he had said that Binghamton University had just purchased 3,000 licenses of Zoom, and that they're going to teach or deliver the lectures for the remaining of the semester through Zoom. You know, so you think about this grand experiment that is now being forced upon us. You know, this grand experiment where universities used to claim in the past that all of the education had to be done face to face, and that these online trainings and education were not up to par. They're now embracing it, and I think that you know, I hope some. I'm sure that somebody's going to be collecting and analyzing the data in the future, but I think that you're going to see some paradigm shifts with respect to remoteness. You know, in fact, you know, here I'm in Frankfurt, Germany, and you're there in Connecticut, and here we are conducting this podcast. I mean, the only real challenge is you know, the time difference, right?
Absolutely. And you know, Joe, I'm glad you brought up this topic. It's honestly one of my favorite topics, and I'm going to pick up my two daughters who are in college in Worcester, Massachusetts. The campus is now closed for the rest of the semester, so it's going to hit home for us as they learn to do the remote learning. But I'm flashing back to a lean transformation I went through not that long ago, and it was at MassMutual, and it's a company that you know, is performing financially very, very well, but they recognized the need to transform the way in which they were doing things, very, very outdated ways of working, and increasing competitive pressures. So they went through a five-year lean transformation journey. And as part of that, it's a company where most of the workers were all in one place. Everything was face-to-face in either Springfield, Massachusetts, or Enfield, Connecticut, other than, you know, sales offices around the country and a couple of smaller international operations. And so as the lean transformation came through, they introduced some basic tools like daily huddles. And literally hundreds of huddle boards were brought in, you know, over the course of, you know, 18 months as teams and organizations were deployed into the lean transformation model. And it was a Shingo model that was brought in, at least for the first 18 months. You know, McKinsey was heavily involved in kind of rolling it out. So fantastic experience for me. But from a remote perspective, what we learned over the course of the 5 years is that, you know, there were absolutely benefits of huddling and, you know, akin to like, you know, starting your class and getting together, that there were absolutely benefits of, you know, doing morale checks and checking on your key deliverables and identifying problems and focusing on gaps on KPIs. Those conversations were fantastic live. And there was definitely a benefit of being together, but there were some downsides too. So the huddle board didn't, you know, have or keep a history on what you were putting on the board. So it was difficult to do trending. And then it was very difficult. Actually, it was a dissatisfier for anyone calling into the huddle. And there always seemed to be someone that was calling in. So what we worked on in the OE community when we picked up on this trend and the need for remote participation was we built electronic huddle boards. And I know that's trending more now. It's more common, although I haven't seen a perfect version of it out there or something that's, you know, close to perfect, but it's getting better. We built our own in MassMutual and found that, boy, that the remote participation was way, way better. And so the net-net, I'll try to kind of bring this story to a conclusion. The net-net is using the electronic huddle board, there were actually advantages. The keeping the history was definitely one of them. The remote participation was one of them. But I will say we couldn't quite replicate the effectiveness of the actual huddle. So if you're having a 15-minute live huddle, there was something about being together that I have yet to replicate in terms of using remote huddle boards. In my role today, my team is spread across the country, so we're forced to use the electronic format. I think we're getting better and better. Maybe we get that 80% to 90%, and there's so many benefits of having the flexibility to hire and engage people across the country or across the world, as you mentioned, our Zoom meeting, our podcast right now. But that there's something about that live conversation that I think is going to be a challenge for the universities, high schools on down the line when they move to remote learning. It's hard. If you haven't done it before, like anything, it takes repetition. And I think they're going to find they may at least initially be missing some of the effectiveness.
Yeah, I think that, you know, I was speaking with somebody at university. I told my department chair, Muhammad, I said, listen, the biggest risk I see to this is that the professors are going to realize that they could deliver their lectures from some beach in the Caribbean. Okay. But, you know, all, you know, kidding aside, I do think that face-to-face is necessary because, you know, team building and, you know, getting to understand and to trust the people that you're with. I don't mean trust in a nefarious, like intent kind of, but trust what they're capable of, what they're not capable of, you know, what might be going on there in their lives that might be influencing, you know, their ability to engage. So I think that, you know, ideally what I think what will happen is that the theoretical, the forensic, the details can be delivered remotely. But I think that, you know, for lack of a better term, a summer camp is going to be needed just for everybody to get together and level set against one another before they go on their separate ways again or semi-autonomous ways again.
Absolutely. And what they have going for them, I think, is that the relationships are established first. And so I do think it's a whole lot more difficult to start remote and build the relationships and then build that teamwork. Yeah. But if you've already built the relationship in person and then moved to a remote setting, you're starting from a much better point. And
yeah, I agree.
You know, it even plays out in business. I was talking to a colleague a few weeks ago about the trend to remote work, and he has a small consulting business. And he told me something similar, that the initial sale, the initial relationship building with clients still has to be done in person from his perspective. And then once that's established, yes, he moves to a lot more remote facilitation, but he hasn't found a way to replace that initial relationship building.
Well, in the consulting and the knowledge business, as you and I are both in, our clients or our colleagues can't take us for a test drive. It's not like we're buying a car, right? So, they need to see that face to face and look into that person's eyes and know that they can trust them. Beyond what's on the CV or beyond any book that they've written or anything else like that, what can this person do? I've, broke bread with them. Are we philosophically aligned? I think is going to be is what needs to be established up front for that relationship to take root.
Yeah, completely agree.
So, how did you get into the field of OpEx and CI in the first place?
Well, I was actually a finance guy, believe it or not. My first role out of college was General Electric's financial development program. And, great entry point out of college. And then after 4 years, I found a financial development program at Cigna, which was actually a very natural next step. It was relatively new. It was actually started just a few years before I joined it, with the goal of creating more general finance and operational leaders. So it was meant for more mid-level. And the person that was leading the program is actually now the CEO of Cigna. So back then, pretty impressive individual. You didn't know that he was necessarily going to be CEO, but there was a vision there. And so I took a chance leading. GE at the time was an incredibly strong company, but there was something pretty unique about that development approach, the rotational experience development approach that I just went for, and ultimately led me from being a finance generalist into operations. And about, I want to say it was 2004, I had the opportunity to take a black belt class, and that was really the inflection point of going from a finance generalist to an operational excellence professional. I had one of those black belt mentors that I'm actually still close to today. It's like that favorite teacher in high school or college that you always remember. This is that for me. Just someone that really inspired me, and showed me what kind of impact you could have in this type of work. He made it fun. He made it interesting. So shout out to Mark Zabel, who is well known in the operational excellence industry and the Six Sigma Master Black Belt circle. So I still stay in touch with Mark today, and that was really the inflection point. The second one was, I didn't go full time, so I was still a finance generalist. I was the finance leader for a large service operation at the time of going through training. I went back to finance generalist roles, but eventually it was that lean transformation at MassMutual, where I saw a whole different way to apply OE, different from the very targeted project-oriented Six Sigma methodology, which started all the way back at Motorola, then GE, and others followed in the 90s and 2000s. The trend in the last 10 years towards these holistic business system transformations through either Shingo or Baldrige, those models are probably the most popular. To experience that, I was the first team to go through it at MassMutual. I knew at that point that that's what I was going to do going forward. It was just fit. I think that the finance background in terms of understanding the financial impacts and doing some of the analysis underneath some of the business system operations, that was helpful. It was arguably differentiating, but really understanding that beyond just targeted projects, that there's a system that can better help a business achieve its goals. and that it's not that hard, but frankly, most people don't do a lot of those things well, it struck a chord in me that I felt like I could really help teams and organizations implement approaches like that to perform better and to achieve their goals better.
So you know, with your being in the field for as long, you know, what do you see are some of the trends in CI and OE over the last, you know, say 1 or 2 decades?
Well, I'll go back to the Six Sigma trend. You know, back in the really, I think it's the late 80s and certainly into the 90s. You know, I was at GE when it became popular there. 93 to 97. I never went through the training at that time, but I was a finance plant manager. And I remember towards the end of my GE tenure that I was starting to be asked to report on metrics for Six Sigma. So I knew it was coming. But that trend, believe it or not, is still, I would say it's still how most companies think about operational excellence. It's very much a targeted project focus. And it's not for everybody. So if you think of the number of people in an organization or a company that actually lead Six Sigma projects, it's the minority. Even for the companies that deploy it as broadly as possible, it is much more of a targeted problem-solving effort, reducing variation, solving problems. The combination with Lean gets the waste reduction in there. It's very, very effective on a targeted basis. But I think the shortcoming that people have started to recognize more and more is that it doesn't necessarily transform a company or an organization. It's very good for solving complex targeted problems. And so where it's changed, and it, you know, this is not new. You know, if you think of like a lean business system, and I know they didn't call it that when it started, but if you think of the Toyota journey over the last 4, even 5 decades. If you think of how the Baldrige program in the U.S. has evolved over the last 4 or 5 decades, they both have common purposes. They both are trying to implement a systemic approach to have an organization perform better, achieve goals better. The Baldrige program's stated purpose is, you know, when it was established by the Commerce Secretary, again, I think it's 5 decades ago now, was to help U.S. companies compete better internationally. Those systemic approaches, they're elusive. At the end of the day, you can go in and evaluate any given company or organization on those models. And frankly, on a 5-point scale, every time I've ever done an assessment, that teams or companies or organizations will score usually like a 2 or 2.5. Very, very few kind of get to the higher levels of maturity. And frankly, it's those few that get to the higher levels of maturity that, you know, meet that definition of excellence. They're the ones that, you know, achieve better over time. There was a recent picture on LinkedIn that showed over the last 20 years, the Malcolm Baldrige Program Award winners and how they've done in the stock market. I know the Toyota comparisons on the Shingo side sometimes fall short, so it's a cautionary tale. But the Baldrige program winners over the last 20 years have significantly outperformed the markets. So it's I believe that's the trend, is that I see more and more companies recognizing the opportunity of implementing a more systemic approach. And it crystallizes for them when they see what the models look like, and they say, oh yeah, we should be doing that. Why wouldn't we be doing some of those fundamentals? And then they do even a self-assessment, and they realize, wow, we don't do a lot of these basics well. And so they decide to embrace you know, a program like that. I'm getting a little wordy here, but I think it's important to add that there's a significant percentage of those efforts that actually aren't as successful as they'd like them to be. I mean, some estimates are as high as 90%. I don't know if it's quite that high in terms of gaining some benefit, but in terms of gaining the expected benefit and having that you know, systemic approach sustain over time, it's a relatively small number that actually are able to do it. So to sum it up, the best way, from my experience, that companies can approach OE and kind of where I think the trend is going, is you need to do both. You need to implement a systemic approach for your organization to get better that engages all employees. And that'll have, you know, it's like your 401k, it'll have small impacts over time, but it'll build to something big. And then you need to complement that with an ability to have your Navy SEALs come in and solve a really complex cross-functional problem, because your average employee is not going to be able to do that. That's where things right. like Six Sigma are great.
I think, you know, one of the biggest challenges, and you know, you being on the inside and the experience that you have, you could, you know, offer a yay or nay or sideways kind of perspective. But I think the one of the big challenges is that we make it so complex that the rank and file can't relate to it. You know, the syntax that we use, you know, they don't understand the why, you know, to borrow from Simon Sinek. You know, why are we doing this? What is it? I mean, you're using these MBA words and I can't understand what it is that you're saying. You know, we're trying to get the warehouse guy on board, you know, the new employees on board, and they have the foggiest idea. And the other challenge, I think, is that oftentimes, you know, these programs and the philosophies and methodologies turn into a, you know, some sort of dogma where they're supposed to be followed unquestioningly. And if you vary, then you're a heretic and you don't get it. And in reality, you know, people want to get it. And if they don't, whose fault is it? Is it the person that doesn't get it or the person trying to explain it? So, you know, what do you think about all that? I mean, I just laid a lot on you, but.
No, I think you're right on, Joe. There are a growing number of studies to figure out, you know, why sometimes, in the minority of times, companies are able to implement these holistic business system improvement models, and more often than not, why they're not. I actually facilitated a session at the Northeast Lean Conference a few months ago with about 40 lean professionals, where we spent a half a day with structured problem solving and getting a broad set of feedback as to what are the causes of why these things don't work. And you mentioned several of them. So, you know, first of all, oftentimes when it fails, people feel like it's being done to them and they don't understand the real purpose, or they don't embrace the purpose. So, you know, that feeling of forced immediately says, hey, you know, I don't want to do this, and it probably is not going to put in the effort and get the repetitions and have the motivation to make it work. You know, the other piece that goes with that is that when it's forced, it's also often tools-based. So when it's introduced, it'll be presented as, you will do it this way. Your huddle board will look this way. Your problem-solving approach will be done in this way. Very format-based, tools-based, and it takes away the mastery, autonomy, and purpose of the employees that are needed for true engagement. And you know, I saw it happen again and again, actually, in you know, so many successes and lessons learned in my first experience with Lean Transformation at MassMutual. But I would say this was something that they learned two or three years in, that it still felt forced and that it was way too tools-based. And so we started to switch and actually had some nice successes after that. The other pieces that go with it, and these are not small, the leader behavior, and it almost goes without saying, but then it's also worth reinforcing, it will not work if the leaders don't fully buy in and lead by example and behave and reinforce the components of the business system that's being implemented and reward people and make it safe for them to try things, then it's just not going to work. And quite honestly, you know, we've done hearts and minds problem solving on this. You know, even when the CEO wants it to happen, as it trickles down, if you don't have the next layers fully bought in and demonstrating and leading by example, then people start to revert back to old ways of doing things. The final piece is that you need OE expertise. Your practitioners or your change agents that are helping to mentor even the most senior leaders, frontline teams. It all comes together in kind of a almost a perfect storm of why something might not work. Picture an employee feeling forced. They don't understand the purpose. They're being told to use certain tools. They're not seeing their leader kind of do the things they're being asked to do. And then you have a change agent that really hasn't done a lot of this before. It's almost like I stayed at a Holiday Inn Express last night. I remember the feeling where when we launched this in MassMutual, that there were some tremendous experts from McKinsey that helped us launch it. And I had one sitting with me every day that made it a really fun experience and I think an impactful experience. The problem is when the consultant goes away, if you don't have that expertise built into your organization to continue to coach and mentor the teams, it starts to go away pretty quickly. And then you almost have the opposite effect. When you have someone trying to mentor that's not equipped to be a mentor and isn't really helping the leaders and the teams implement and sustain these systems, again, they're going to tune them out. They're going to go back to the other ways of doing things. I'll never forget that there was one actuarial team that I was working with, and the corporate actuary I would coach and mentor and have many, many conversations. And I remember the reason I was brought in to help them was that they were perceived as being resistant, and they weren't following the formats and the tools that they were being asked to do. And he was open about it. He was resisting because he didn't think the way in which that they were proposing he do things was working. And so we listened and we observed, many, many go and sees, and we saw how they were applying the system. And they were almost ahead of their time. They weren't really leveraging the huddle board, but they had their own version of an electronic huddle board in Excel tabs. And, they would project it on the wall. And it was just very different from the way in which other teams were doing it and kind of the standards that were established in the center of excellence. But if you really took a step back and watched what they were doing, they had a tremendous volume of problems being solved. They were getting to, identifying problems, getting to root causes and solving them. They had performance metrics, which they knew where they were off, and when they were off, it drove problem solving. I could keep going. The different components of their system, the development of the team, the morale checks, the interaction, that they actually were more mature than the other organizations in finance and across the company. And when the more seasoned operational experts came to look at it, they all agreed, like, wow, these people are applying the principles in different ways, but they're doing it more effectively. So they're not following the tools or the formats that others may be following, but this gets to where I think it can be more effective. When principles are introduced to smart people and smart teams, and every company, they're all going after the same talent. There's many, many people that could, there's reasons they're in their roles. If you give them the principles, they're going to be able to turn that into something great. If you force them to do things a certain way that they're not comfortable doing, you're going to short circuit the process. So that was a lot, but hopefully that's helpful.
You're talking, I see that, and I think you used the phrase, engagement versus inspiration. You have to, these programs and these efforts have to, people have to connect with them on a personal level, I believe, for them to be, for them to penetrate and to be sticky. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I would agree. And I do think there's a difference between engagement and inspiration. And if you put them together, if you look at some of the studies out in the marketplace, even together, the percentage of employees that fit one of those two categories, I'm going to get the numbers wrong, but I want to say it's certainly over half of employees are perceived to be disengaged. It might be 2/3. And then if you then break down the category of employees that are engaged versus employees that are inspired, the inspired employees are by far the minority. And so how do you get, the disengaged to engaged? And honestly, the business system approach, your Baldrige approach, your Shingo approach, could be different. But some systemic approach like that to engage all employees, when applied effectively, principle-based, leaders leading by example, not feeling forced, the right expertise supporting. That to me is the number one solution to drive, broader engagement. So not onesie twosie incremental improvement, but getting broad populations of employees from disengaged to engaged. That to me is an obvious answer. To get from engaged to inspired is a different story, and that's much more about the environment. That it's the leader and it's the team and the roles that they're in and the environment that's created and the synergy between them that is a little bit different for everyone, but it's that unique combination that creates what I would say is the synergy needed to create inspiration.
Yeah. Inspiration, is going to come, I believe, with a passion for the work. And let's face it, there's a lot of people that don't have a passion for the work. They're doing the work to get a paycheck to support their livelihood. I believe that you can get people engaged, for them to understand their place in, the whole ecosystem. But it's a different thing between getting people engaged and inspired. Inspired means that they're emotionally involved. And I think that might be a bridge too far to expect that everybody's going to get inspired, because people are hired and are taking the work in the first place, not for inspiration, but for sustenance.
It's a fantastic point, Joe. And I completely, completely agree. If, finding a passion doesn't necessarily mean that it's consistent with your purpose. And, the purpose is the starting point, I guess, would be my reaction. I can use my own example. I don't know if I was ever truly inspired in my finance roles. And it was a big chunk of my career. It was more than half of my career. The inspiration happened when I made the switch, when the inflection point towards operational excellence. That was more consistent with my purpose. And then it became about finding the right role in the type of work that I like to do with the right leadership, with the right company. So completely agree. And it's elusive. I mean, it is the minority of workers that actually find that. But I would say when you do, those are the components that are in place.
Yeah, so what are some of the key characteristics of the most successful OE practitioners, given all that?
Let's see. The first thing that comes to mind is repetition, and it's interesting that's what OE practitioners teach to others, is that you learn something like a business system, or you learn a Six Sigma approach. It takes many, many times to get good at that, and so that's like any other discipline. I mentioned the actuaries. The corporate actuary is not a high potential that within a year or two gets to the role. It's probably 20 years of experience and growing responsibility that ultimately gets them there. It's the same with OE. The people like yourself, Joe, that 30 years experience doing this, you can tell you're passionate about it. There's something to that, that the combination of the purpose and the passion and the repetition will get them there. It's combined with the next words that come to mind are curiosity and empathy. So to get that repetition in different settings, you have to be naturally curious. Different industries, different countries, different types of organizations. It's important to see different things and apply your craft and refine your craft in that way. It'll make you better. And then within that, the empathy. I think back of what made some parts of lean transformations unsuccessful. It can't be the way that you as an OE practitioner want to do it. It has to be principle-based and applied in ways that make sense for your customer or your client. The only way to do that is with empathy. So to seek to understand, the listening and the empathetic understanding of their problems, and then bring them the principles that might help and allow them to apply those in ways that make the most sense. The final piece, and you might see those three, so your repetition, your curiosity, your empathy, that'll make you successful. What makes you truly differentiated, I believe, is the outcome focus. And it's part of why I think some OE programs go away, is that when there's not clear outcomes that are demonstrated, that companies will go away from it. There's eventually a point where if the investment is not deemed to have the appropriate return, that you know, in the business cycles, that the OE team may go away, they may get downsized. But there's plenty of examples of that. I think you wrote about it in your book. You know, the outcome focus combined with, you know, the experience and the curiosity and the empathy, if you can consistently show the outcomes over time, it's hard to imagine that you wouldn't be successful.
Thank you for that. So let's take a break. And when we come back, we'll talk about, you know, what are some of the key success factors, why things fail, you know, what's the next big thing, and wrap it up. So you've been listening to State of Readiness, your host, Joseph Paris, and we have with us as our guest, Joe Vacca, and we'll be right back.
This episode of State of Readiness, sponsored by the Operational Excellence Society, a think tank, a creator and aggregator of knowledge and know-how, serving businesses and professionals who wish to learn more on the various topics which combined comprise the discipline of operational excellence. Learn more at www.opexsociety.org.
Welcome back, everybody. This is Joseph Paris, and you're listening to State of Readiness. My guest today is Joe Vacca, Vice President of Operational Excellence at Cigna. Welcome back there, Joe.
Hey, thanks, Joe. Great to be here.
Yeah. So, you know, we've covered, you know, your history and some of your ideas and experiences with respect to operational excellence, but you know, why do you see some of these OPEX programs fail? And, you know, fail, let's put that in context for a second. I've never seen any OPEX or CI program leave things worse off than when they started. I mean, have you?
No, that's a very fair point. I don't think there's ever a downside to the attempt to transform.
Right. So assuming that for a second, where do they fail? I mean, my opinion is that they fail to meet an expectation that probably was never set in the first place. And if it was, it was set on unrealistic and unfounded expectations. You know, what would you think about those, that kind of statement?
Well, I think the ultimate goal of any of these programs is to ultimately drive better results over time. I mean, that's inherent in OE as a discipline, and it's inherent in these programs. So I would, you know, in kind of Six Sigma style, I'd like to differentiate kind of the output metrics or output variables from the input metrics of an OE transformation. So the output is better results over time that will bring you closer to achieving your mission. It'll help you achieve your objectives faster, and it'll achieve your mission better for your customers. But it takes time. And the theory is that the inputs are the way in which you're working. And you want to improve those inputs, improve the ways in which you're working, improve your business system to drive those results. And it fits into the categories of problem solving. It fits into the categories of delivering products and services to your customers. It fits into the categories of culture and behaviors and employee development. You know, the Shingo model has all of these components, the Baldrige model, some of the custom models. It almost doesn't matter the model that you pick. What's important is that it's a systemic approach and that you drive improvements in that systemic approach over time that will ultimately drive the better outcomes. And so when I say 90% fail, it's not that there aren't benefits. There are always some benefits individually. So some may get more than others from going through the experience. The company, even if temporarily, gets some better results, then that's great. Where I say fail, and I'll move it to the sustainment category, does the company really change the way it's operating? Is it maturing the elements of those business systems so that it is systemically driving better results over time? And the best way we have to measure that is, let's go back to the inputs and the outputs. Are the inputs getting better? So you can measure the maturity of those inputs. And then is that driving better results? And from the experiences that I've had and from the research that I've done, far more often than not, at the end of the transformation, that companies revert back to their old behaviors, and that you can't demonstrate that even small changes in those behaviors have led to better results.
So we're almost talking about culture. We talk about, you know, people changing, but the overarching environment in which they're operating doesn't change. Therefore, it doesn't sustain. Is that what I'm hearing?
Culture is a big piece of it. Absolutely.
Yeah. You know, I have this belief that companies, we talk about transformation, right? You know, everybody's on the transformation bandwagon, but I don't believe that companies transform unless they're faced with some peril or some disruptor that possesses truly destructive power. This is not to say that destructive power has to be used, but just that it exists. I think about the saying about Cortez. When he got to the New World, he burned his ship so that his men were properly motivated. If we allow people to go backwards, they will go backwards because that's where their comfort zone is. We're getting into a little bit of psychology here now, but culture is about psychology after all. If we're asking people to transform, but there's no real, and I'm not talking about burning platform where you're, instilling fear in somebody's hearts, because I don't believe in motivating by fear. But if we're faced with some peril and we know that we have to move from here to there, and we can get everybody to recognize that that peril exists, then we can move mountains pretty quick. I think about General Motors. For 50 years, everybody knew this was an increasingly sick company, it never changed. Their unit costs were going up, their quality was going down, their market share was going down. And, along comes one financial crisis, and, General Motors is in and out of bankruptcy in 30 days, shed of its 50 years worth of sins and baggage. I think that, that's what's going to transform a company. That's what's necessary to transform a company. But I think that companies can be disrupted if they know that they have to go from one level of being and performance to another, if that makes any sense whatsoever.
It makes a ton of sense. Although I'm going to offer beyond the burning platform, I would agree that's the easier way to do it. So when you are forced to change and you try something and it begins to work, you're going to keep doing it. So the other way to do it, and this is why I think sustainment is so elusive when companies try these transformation efforts, is without the burning platform, how do you incent your employees, your leaders and your employees, to try this new way of working and get them to try it enough and give them enough repetitions and make them open to trying it, possibly even embracing the opportunity, to get them to do it enough where they see the results? And when they see the results, hey, if something's working for you, you try it and you end up doing something better, you're going to do it again. And that reinforcement then sustains. So how do you launch that cycle without the burning platform? And that's where I'd get back to leadership. So if the majority of companies that are launching transformation efforts aren't actually on a burning platform, you almost by default have to make sure your most senior leaders are fully bought in and they understand enough about what's expected of them that they can execute that over time. And it's not just a few month thing. It's not just another project. It's not just something they're going to put up with, that they're truly all in together as a team. Then I think you have a chance.
I agree with that. So can everyone achieve excellence?
I honestly don't think so. I know that's maybe a little bit counter to what most people think, But you know, maybe it gets back to what is the definition of excellence. You know, to me, excellence is a level of high sustained performance over time that's truly differentiating and that's delighting customers. That's hard to do. There's very few examples in the business world of a company that's been able to distance themselves from all of their competitors, you know, continuously improve their performance from that point, have customers that are delighted time after time after time. To me, that's the benchmark. And it's not just business. You know, think of any discipline. Sports analogies are easy here. I'm a big basketball fan. So if you take kind of the college basketball and the UCLA dynasty under John Wooden, which had a business system, by the way, the pyramid of success, unprecedented dominance. And if you think of all of the college basketball teams over the last century and you see the outlier that UCLA is, not a surprise that it's a business system, very different from others, that they're doing something different than every other team at the time, with tremendous leadership, with inspired players. You know, the UConn women's basketball is also a favorite of mine, and honestly, their record is not that dissimilar, just in a different time, a different decade, but not that dissimilar to what happened at UCLA. They were truly doing something different. So to me, excellence, it's, think of the normal distribution curve, it's that last 2% on the right side of the normal distribution. How do you get there? You know, most can't, but it's absolutely the right goal. And when you embark on an operational excellence journey, the great news is even if you don't get to be that far outlier, you're going to move in that direction. And it's how far you want to take it that will determine if you truly achieve excellence.
It's interesting that years ago, remember the Dos Equis commercial with the world's most interesting man?
Sure.
Okay. I love those commercials. Anyway, they always had some theme, right? So in this one, it was a 15-second spot, probably the best spot of them all. And it was on careers. All right. And, you know, the guy's sitting in the leather chair in the mahogany room, you know, and the camera zooms in and the gentleman says, find out in this life what you don't do well and then don't do that thing. Okay. So excellence, you know, has to do a little bit with talent, right? I mean, and we're going to say, for lack of a better term, God-given talent. Like, I love golf. Okay. I get my money's worth on the course. No matter how many buckets of balls I would ever hit in my entire life, no matter how many trainers and coaches I'd ever have, I would never be on the PGA Tour. It would be inevitable because I don't have the skills. They can't be bought. They couldn't be trained. It's just the way it is. So I think that if we're looking at, you know, achieving a level of excellence, we have to figure out, first off, what we're predisposed for being excellent at. And then we got to try to be the very best at it that we can be. And, you know, in business, you know, we have to try to, and I think this is also up to our mentors within our companies to try to figure out, you know, what's our individual superpowers? What is this guy good at or gal good at? What do they excel at? What do they love? And then see if there's an intersect between that and what the needs of the company are. And if you do that time and again, you know, you're going to have the right people in the right roles that are excelling in those roles naturally, and they're supported and they can hold in those skills so that individually they're high performing, collectively they're high performing teams, and ultimately they're in a high performing organization. But it's not easy. There's no pill you can take or button you could push that's going to make it happen fast.
Yeah, completely agree. And I love the word predisposition. As you were describing it, it was popping into my head. But from that predisposition, the repetition, the feedback loops, I would add humility in there, being real open to that feedback and understanding there's a lot of development that has to take place over time and connecting it to purpose.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So we're in the speed round. You ready? A couple
ready.
Of really quickie questions here. So what's the one leader you look up to most and why?
I love Warren Buffett. And it's, boy, the reasons. The word that comes to mind when I think of him is authenticity. I mean, he is truly a unique leader. He leads really differently than almost any other leader. There's a video that often circulates on LinkedIn of Warren and Bill Gates, and they're talking about the importance of time. And there's a quote that Warren shares. I think they actually show, he opens up his calendar and there's nothing, well, let's say there's nothing in it, but there's a few meetings in it. I think they look out a month or so. And if you compare that to, you know, most calendars of leaders in corporations, I mean, people are overwhelmed. You know, and it's the imbalance creates dissatisfaction, it creates performance issues, it creates anxiety for many. Think of, and it's getting worse over time. Think of the time pressures. I think what you're finding, and it's related to employee engagement scores on down the line, is you know, people are getting overwhelmed with the demands on their time. And here's, you know, one of the richest men in the world who's running one of the most successful companies with huge blocks of time on his calendar that are open. And the quote that I'll never forget that he shared with Bill Gates was, "I can buy essentially anything I want, but the one thing I can't buy is time. So I better be careful with it." And it's just so true. You know, to have the courage, and I guess having that much success over time allows you to be more courageous, but to lead in that way, his focus on the basics and consistency over time, I think it resonates with an OE type audience really well. But, you know, there's almost a value stream there, Joe. It's if time is connected to your own value stream, you know, we have the opportunity as OE practitioners, but just as individuals, even on the personal side, to figure out, you know, time is scarce, and the things we choose to do arguably have different values. You know, there are some things, if you think of the Kano model, where, you know, you've got, you know, things that you do that meet basic needs, you got things that you do that you like that, you know, more is better, and then there's those few things that you do that are truly delighters. You know, have we thought of managing our time in that way? And you know, removing the non-value-added things that we do. So get your basic needs, but increase the proportion of more is better type activities and try to find more delighters. I've actually experimented with this. And if you track time, and I know, you know, in most settings, tracking time is no fun. It's been tried in the corporate setting and maybe misapplied, but it's not, you know, most people don't like to track their time. But there's a huge value in it. If you actually plot out how you're spending your time and you try to figure out within your own value system, within your purpose, what are the things that create the most value for you, and you start adjusting how you spend your time, you're going to be that much more likely to achieve your purpose. It's no different than, you know, if you're going to go on a diet, most likely you're going to start tracking what you eat and you're going to make adjustments over time. If you are having financial difficulty, you're going to create a budget and you're going to track how you're spending your money. You know, time, you don't get it back. You know, if someone gave you $1 million to spend every day, my guess is that you'd spend it. You know, time is treated in the same way and we look to maximize how we spend it, I think it would drive a lot more satisfaction. And frankly, we control more of our calendars than we think. It's something that me and my team have been experimenting with and kind of improving our own value streams and, you know, saying no to various things. But a lot of that was triggered by the concepts that Warren Buffett has introduced. And it's really his unique leadership has clearly resonated with me.
But do you wonder, just you don't have to answer this, of course, but do you wonder what the people that work for Warren Buffett, what their calendars look like?
Probably not as good as his.
Probably not. I would probably agree with that. So what's your personal habit that contributes to your success?
I would say reflection.
Okay, so why? And first off, how and then why? Or why and then how? We're looking at Simon Sinek. Start with the why, right? Why is reflection a personal habit that contributes to your success? And then how do you invoke it?
Well, there's learning. Reflection to me is an opportunity to learn. And, so if you think of successes and probably more importantly, failures, there's reinforcement from successes that it, to me is worth spending time thinking about. So what made it successful and how can I keep doing that? Apply it in other ways to other things to make those things successful. More importantly, and frankly, it's more difficult is the reflection and the adjustment coming off of failures. For me personally, that takes a lot more time. It's easier to kind of reflect and glance over successes and move on to the next thing. For me, the failures take longer to figure out. And then once you figure it out, it takes even longer to make the adjustment, to truly, come to terms with what happened? Why didn't that go so well? What role did I have in that? And it's got to be a big part of it.
Yeah.
So let's make sure that we're focusing on what I can do differently. And then how do you actually apply that? It might be something I'm not strong at doing. So back to our earlier conversation, how do I get better at that particular thing, or how do I prevent that shortcoming from happening? And it does get back to repetition over time as well. So if you keep reflecting and you keep learning and you keep adjusting, it's hard to think that loop can happen without the reflection.
So what's the best piece of advice you've ever received? And who'd you hear that from? Who shared that advice with you?
Run your own race. Yeah, I'd say run your own race. I'm pausing because that's the phrase that came to mind first. I'm struggling with who actually shared it. I know it was shared with a mentor early on, but it's one of those phrases that every time I hear it, I gravitate to it. And I found myself sharing it with my daughter just last week as she is beginning to interview for internships and the competition heats up. Ultimately, it's never going to be satisfying comparing how you're doing to someone else. And if you are, and let's say you get there, and that's your goal is to beat someone else or get to a certain competitive level, chances are there's always going to be someone else that's in front of you, and there's also going to be someone else behind you. So it's kind of this never-ending path that doesn't necessarily lead to satisfaction. I might feel good for a moment, but you're just going to keep on repeating the cycle, versus focusing on what's your purpose, what makes you happy, what do you value, and make strides towards that. It's always going to leave you more satisfied. So it's something that just over time has resonated with me, and I'm big on sports analogies, and have run. Running's been one of my hobbies for many years, so that may be the other reason.
So, last question, and then we'll wrap up here. So, if you had one do-over, doesn't have to be professional; it could be personal; it could be anything you want. If you had one do-over, what would it be?
I'm going to make it a little bit broad. And so this may not fit your question, but I probably wouldn't, I wouldn't worry as much about things. You know, it's as I kind of look back, and you know, you think of different points, and this is a little bit more career focused. And maybe a piece of it is because I'm kind of watching my daughters enter the working world, and you know, I can see them get you know, ready for interviews and things like that, and they're kind of going through the rigors of college and kind of the academics. But I think of the different stages that I went through in education and in career, and I think of kind of the worry or some of the anxiety that builds, and you know, it always works out. And you know, for better or worse, you know, it's your path. And you know, for the vast majority of the time, things work out just great. And then I think of the amount of time that you could always be enjoying those things, or you could be focused on the things that you know you're worried about and could go wrong. And over time, I found myself kind of moving away from that and just embracing the opportunities and not worrying as much about you know, what could go wrong, that it's, you just be your authentic self and go forward. I wasn't like that earlier in my career. I got much more anxious, nervous about kind of big events, big goals. And, yeah, I wish I could have just been, more, in the enjoyment of those opportunities. So it's kind of a continuum over time. So not kind of one moment, but yeah, that's the one thing maybe I would do a little bit differently.
Not stress as much, not worry as much.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's good. You know, it's funny because, you know, this is 35 years ago. I was engaged to my wife, who's we're still married now after all these years. And at a family reunion, each of my uncles took me for a walk around the house that we're visiting, one of my uncle's houses. And each uncle would walk me around the house and give me his marital advice. All right. And, you know, each of these divorced uncles would take me for a walk around the house and give me their advice. And this one uncle, Uncle Scotty, was the one that was married. He brought me for a walk around the house. In front of the house, where you know, there were no people, he stopped me, and he faced me, and he pointed to my right side of my chest. And he says, "This is the beginning of your life." And then he pointed to the left side of my chest. He says, "This is the end of your life." And he squiggled the finger in between, and he says, "Whatever happens is going to happen in here, so don't worry about it." And I thought that was some real wisdom there. There was some real wisdom there. So, yeah, kudos to Uncle Scotty. All right. So, Joe, thank you very, very much for taking all the time and joining me today. I really appreciated it a great deal. And thank you for sharing all your insights.
Yeah. Thanks, Joe, for the opportunity. Really enjoyed this. And thank you for putting these stories out there.
Super. So, you've been listening to State of Readiness with your host, Joseph Paris. And our guest today has been Joe Vacca, Vice President of Operational Excellence at Cigna. Thank you very much for joining us and hope to see you again.
Thank you for listening to State of Readiness. You can discover more episodes and learn about the book written by Joseph Paris of the same title at www.state-of-readiness.com. You can learn more about Joseph Paris at www.josephparis.me/card.